Welcome to the first in a season of Vox Talks recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. It's our annual tradition. In the next few weeks, we're going to be covering subjects from social class to crypto and from trade wars to telecommuting based on the presentations and panels that took place at the Banque de France and Sciences Po this year. So if you don't want to miss out, follow us wherever you get your podcasts. We start with an ambitious application of artificial intelligence to help agencies and governments cope with natural disasters. As the symposium kicked off, CEPR published a policy insight on the topic of automated prediction systems for humanitarian anticipatory action. It was written by CEPR's Humanitarian Forecast Working Group, which brings together economists, policymakers, and practitioners. I caught up with Margarita Philipp, a data scientist at Econ AI, and Hannes Müller of the Barcelona School of Economics, who are two of the 25 authors from around the world. So first of all, I wanted to ask them, how on earth did all the contributors manage to collaborate to create this document?
Let me first explain why there are so many authors. This is basically born out of a workshop that we organized in Barcelona, and it's always very easy to get people to come to Barcelona. So the people we asked to come accepted, and it's a real cross-cutting exercise we did there between academics who are doing forecasting and policymakers in the humanitarian sector and data providers for violence data. Once we were there and we were talking to each other, we realized many of us don't have the answers to the questions that we started to pose in the beginning of the workshop. And then we decided, oh, let's at least put in place a publication to point of this is where we are, this is where we see gaps. And how do we do it? Well, basically, we just had a Google Doc and everybody was piling in. And of course, you know, you have free writing. Some people work more than others. But I think overall, I have to say, Margarita also is the lead author here. So she did a great job in getting us all to participate and work more on it.
It focuses on this principle of anticipatory action. Can you explain exactly what that means?
The basic idea is to reduce the humanitarian impact of a crisis and doing that by acting early. And in order to act early, you need forecasts or some kind of trigger that acts as an early warning sign such that humanitarian response doesn't only get released when the crisis is already in place, but instead you act early. Based on early warning triggers, you already put goods, for example, in place such that when the crisis strikes, everyone's much more prepared through this anticipatory action and the crisis becomes smaller and the impact becomes less, saving lives.
So how much of humanitarian aid is delivered as anticipatory action today?
The estimate we have in the paper is about 0.4%. So
wow.
Other estimates I've read around 1%. That's kind of looking at figures where the actual label of the funding is anticipatory action. Mm-hmm. It's quite hard to estimate these things in reality. And we also note that the metrics for what even counts as a humanitarian response and what counts as an anticipatory action, humanitarian response is also changing over time.
Well, let me ask this then. Do people think that more of this aid should be delivered as anticipatory action?
Let me first stress again that what occurred during the workshop was a real, oh my God, we know so little. I think this needs to be stressed. I don't think this is going to do justice to all the humanitarian organizations. But most don't really know what they're doing in anticipatory action. It's not measured necessarily. It's not separated. So the study of does anticipatory action work, how much does it save in terms of costs, is currently impossible because people don't keep track of what they're doing ahead of time. This reaches from like World Bank, IMF, several foreign offices, now humanitarian actors increasingly, incredibly bad in keeping track of their own things on the ground and what exactly they're doing when and where. humanitarian organizations a little bit more, is my feeling, because they have the responsibility towards the donors. But the donor community, for example, has no idea. So this is, to a large degree, unstudied. There are a few studies out there that say, oh, this really works, it saves a lot of money, right? And I think we cite a few in the paper, but this is, I would say, the tip of the iceberg. Most organizations don't really know how much they would save if they did things in a more anticipatory way.
There's a couple of statistics, like DFID, back when it was called DFID, did a study looking at the reduced cost of procurement. If goods can be procured early, you're paying a lower cost. And the estimates are quite a large range, 11 to 45%. I mean, even 11% is significant. I think it's important to acknowledge that all of this is happening against an over backdrop of a major shortage in funding for humanitarian needs. And so while I think maybe theoretically a lot of people are bought into the idea of anticipatory action and saving money that way, the reality is that there isn't a lot of money to go around in the first place. And so you need quite a lot of faith and confidence that this is worthwhile to take it away from addressing the acute needs of people that are already in need.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about how humanitarian responses work at the moment. When we talk about humanitarian response, can we define it a little bit? What sort of events would we expect in 2025 that will trigger some humanitarian response?
There's two main drivers. One is climate events, big floods, earthquakes, and wars, violence. Mm-hmm. So these two have been dealt with in very different ways. And of course, they are differently predictable. Let me give you two examples, I think, that make very clear of why it is perhaps easy to predict what will happen in 2025 and sometimes very hard. So the easy cases, easy really not in the sense of they're not very dramatic and terrible for the people involved, but easy in terms of just predictability. So this is Ukraine, Israel, in the broadest sense, Israel, Sudan, Nigeria, Yemen, Ethiopia, Lebanon, Somalia. There's just these cases where it's very obviously true that they are in conflict and that they will remain in conflict. You should have things in place, and you already do, because these are already humanitarian crises that are ongoing. And what we specialize in conflict forecast is trying to predict conflict in places that haven't had massive conflict yet. These are obviously much lower probability, but these are the ones also where then these humanitarian organizations wouldn't be prepared if something happened. So it's a question of, what are you trying to target? Are you trying to target the, this for sure will be a crisis and it's already huge and we have things in place? Or are you trying to target, oh, this is where we would be unprepared and we need to prepare more right now in order to get goods in place? So literally asking the forecasting system, where do we predict the highest fatalities in places that don't currently have fatalities? So this is Kenya, Ecuador, Libya, Uganda, Guatemala. And just to talk about the other main driver, so think of flood events versus earthquakes. Earthquakes are less predictable. And of course, the question is, would you want to prepare for a potential earthquake risk, right? Versus flooding, where there's this Bangladeshi case where OCHA has a very good anticipatory action pilot in place together with other organizations. And they basically have figured out how to measure the water levels in the river upstream and rainfall. And so they can predict quite well, because this is something that has happened before. Therefore, you can anticipate these needs better. But I think that already shows you how complicated this issue is, right? It's not only about figuring out where the rainfall is and where the flood is or where the conflict is, but also what are the needs that would be triggered. We realized in the workshop, we really haven't figured this out. The conflict forecasters are not 100% useful right now because we're not predicting needs. And people have figured out natural disaster forecasting to some degree, but this hasn't kind of swept into the conflict forecasting part yet.
And is there a scale of conflict or an impact of natural disaster? Is there a definition about what would trigger a response?
What I know is the UNICEF way of thinking about it, which is they have three layers to this. What is something that triggers something? then how much can the local community deal with? Mm-hmm. What's the local response, right? So if Germany has a massive flood, nobody sends humanitarian goods to Germany because it is an understanding that Germany will be able to deal with it.
That type of crisis question also matters. Are we talking about people in need of food? Are they in acute risk of hunger, right? It depends on the organization as well, right? WFP will be more focused on the levels of hunger. UNICEF will be more focused on how many children are there in need, right? The UNHCR mm-hmm. will be looking at displacement, and they might have some degree of thresholds, but at the end of the day, it's not a single person who makes that decision in these kind of contexts. And there'll be pots of money that are available throughout the year, and then appeals are made to either use that money or raise additional money for a specific crisis as they unfold, because quite often the problem is that they haven't been anticipated. So at the end of the day, everyone's there and trying to collect more money because it has been decided it's an acute enough crisis. But I don't think there's a single threshold, because quite often these are really complex situations. Although I would say that the big exception there and the pioneering work that's been done in and around anticipatory action is anything to do with floods and droughts and climate shocks and things that can be predicted using meteorological data. And I think a forerider on that front is the START Network, who bring together different member organizations and networks who pool their money really effectively, so it's kind of away from the UN system. They have very clearly defined triggers and thresholds for these specific funds that they've come up with. And I think that's quite impressive, but it's also important to bear in mind that it is that much simpler, in all fairness, to work with meteorological data and predict meteorological events, because yes. things are going to come no matter what the humans do. Whereas the extent to which conflict emerges and how many people end up being affected by it, there are just so many variables that are just really, really hard to predict. Even if they were predictable, we would lack the data.
Historically, how has forecasting been done?
The oldest system is obviously the expert system, right? You have somebody yeah. who knows a lot about the country, who is based in the country very often, or is in a regional office and is watching that. That's the system that is in place in most foreign offices, in mm-hmm. World Bank, in the IMF, in the UN organizations, right, that have sometimes very large local footprints and know their place quite well, and therefore able to collect data, whether that's qualitative data or quantitative data, on the ground, and are there then able to do foresight exercises. And increasingly, there are organizations would have like a central data science team that would use quantitative data and forecast with this quantitative data. But this can also take all kinds of approaches, right? Not necessarily like a machine learning approach. It could be just like holding this data, looking at the data and thinking about like, what does this mean for the local offices?
And what have the problems been historically in forecasting the sorts of events in which you might want to take anticipatory action?
Of course, now we're talking about like whole range of organizations, right?
Yes.
So this is difficult to make very broad tables, but I would say the biggest problems are exactly the problems that any behavioral economist would tell you about human biases and exposed. Everybody has seen it coming, but before it's very hard. It's like this statement about forecasting is hard, especially about the future. And I think this kind of stuff stands in the way of these things being used optimally. But there's also, of course, lots of political problems. Sometimes it's not deemed worth an intervention, even though the local expert says that there's a problem. It's not only a forecasting problem, but like, how does the organization deal with early warnings internally? And then I don't know whether you know this, the Tedlock super forecasters thing, where he shows that maybe it's better not to have experts, but it's better to have neutral minded teams of five people that are able to collect the evidence and try to get rid of these human biases, right, in some way.
You're talking in this document about being able to develop automated prediction systems. If we are going to harness the power of AI to be able to improve this process, first of all, we need data. Do we have enough high quality, unbiased data to be able to train an AI?
I would say in the part of the conflict prediction, the answer is certainly yes.
Right.
I don't think everybody agrees on every data point. Let me just say that, right? There's two organizations that are the big data providers, so ACLED and UCDP. And if you look at their data and you hold them next to each other, you see that they don't always agree. They're also coding different events, they say, but you know, they should be not coding completely differently. And sometimes there's quite a big difference. And the basic truth is that not everybody is interested in the very same phenomenon. So let me give you an example. If you look at our maps, we have Mexico very high up on our risk, and we have Brazil very high up. It's because we take the most lenient definition by UCDP in terms of the definition of the data. Mm-hmm. But FCEO told us, why would you have the one-sided violence? We are only interested in the state-based violence, right? Which is the one that is more associated with this kind of civil war situations, right? Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and so on. And of course, in Brazil and Mexico, it is not an outright civil war. These are gang warfare situations, right? And so where the data isn't there is mostly because people don't have exactly the same definition of what we should be caring about. All in all, there is a very, very thriving, very alive group of research teams, not just one, I think it's like, I would say 5-10 research teams that are doing very good forecasting already. And this group is growing very quickly. And the reason is that there's very good violence data. And so then the next thing is, for example, displacement data. I think everybody agrees that it's highly imperfect. It's also very sensitive data. You can imagine that in a time where European countries want to close their borders, we have the rise of the right wing and the increasing statement like we should get these people out, we should keep them out. The incentives to not share displacement data are also large, right? So it becomes much more political immediately. And so there, it's called a CRAFT, the Complex Risk and Analytics Fund. It's a joint initiative by several governments. They are financing right now an organization to collect this data more systematically, make it public, right? We were working on displacement. And so this is exactly where the front is. It's like we're literally right there. This group of people is working on getting better data on displacement. And then I think humanitarian need data is a shambles. There's no coherent collection across institutions. Every organization collects their own data. That means sometimes there's internally very good data on this, but it's not like public or systematic across all countries.
If you build some kind of automated prediction systems, what sort of information is it best for them to communicate and in what form?
At the very basic level, forecasts give you a probability, or they can give you a regression result, which is typically a point prediction, or maybe like a confidence interval. For example, if we're predicting events, the likelihood of an event occurring, that would fall into the classification target. So it would give you a probability between 0 and 1 of the likelihood of this event occurring. And then mm-hmm. depending on the forecasting horizon you chose, it would say, oh, it's the probability of this happening within the next 3 months, the next 6 months, or the next 3 years, depending on what you've trained the model on. Whereas, yeah, the regression target, we use it, for example, to predict the number of fatalities. And you can expand that to say, okay, well, the number of fatalities with a 90% confidence would fall between this range. But I guess the really difficult part is how to interpret that and what to do with those figures. And we had a really long discussion about this in the workshop as well that formed the basis of this paper, because speaking from experience, I mean, we're producing the forecasts, but we'll take it or leave it at that stage. Whereas at the other end, there are people who then need to use this for their decision making. And it's not obvious what it means for there to be an increase even from, you know, a 0.2 chance of a conflict occurring to 0.3. Mm. What does that mean in practice? And I think the other thing that people were speaking of is just different levels of literacy when it comes to data and forecasting results, and also different amounts of time that people can commit to understanding these results. So there might be more at the data analyst level, people who are really keen to get a lot of information and really understand, well, what was the model trained on and what kind of data is flowing into this? And then there might be someone at a higher level who's just like, give me a number and you know, I'll try my best to act on that, but don't overwhelm me with more information. So I think there's quite a lot of work to be done with that step between what the forecast literally spits out and how it can communicate something yes. meaningful to the people trying to make decisions. And from what we've seen, there's actually a lot more work to be done. And then with the next level goes even beyond just, you know, numerical and saying, what does that mean, to how is that displayed, for example, going kind of into psychological research almost of mm-hmm. color schemes, and how do we display information on maps or individual numbers such that they're well interpreted. And this has been a really long problem. Even when Hannes was speaking about how in the past it was humans communicating forecasts, they had the exact same problem. There's papers about intelligence services having huge internal problems with communicating probabilities or likelihoods of things, because even culturally, people just have different perceptions of what it means for something to be likely. Is that above 50% or above 90%?
Is there an ethical challenge here as well? Because a regression is in some ways explainable if you want to look into it. AI models tend to be a little bit of a black box and they turn out a result, but not necessarily tell you how we arrived at that result.
We had a moment in the workshop where one of the participants said, forget about explainability. We will only make this happen if our models are good. Never sacrifice an inch of performance for explainability. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of attitude from a more like data science, machine learning perspective of somebody saying the credibility that we build with AI is being better than the human, and you can show, right? I'm telling you a list, and then like next year, wow, it's exactly this list of countries that I told you, all these regions, right? And then you're like, oh, okay, I've learned my lesson. I will now start trusting this forecast better. And then we had massive pushback in the group where like two or three people said, no. The way we talk about to policymakers and what our experience is and the conversation with policymakers is completely the opposite. It needs to be explainable. And so stepping a little bit away from this problem to machine learning, the key question is how much data do you have and how sophisticated a model could you train with effect to predict something? So if you have millions of observations to train on and they are of high quality, you can train neural network or transformer architecture, one of these new cool things out there. And you can for sure 100% beat the human in terms of pure performance. And of course, then the question becomes, okay, how do you translate the outputs of a neural network for a human? Like what is driving it? And there's a lot of research on this, obviously, right now, because we're surrounded by these systems. But if you're in a central bank and you're predicting growth in the UK or in France, then you just have 200, 300, 400 observations. And so the gains from using neural network on that are zero, actually. It's worse. The performance is better if you just use a regression. So kind of this trade-off even of how much performance do you give up by doing one or the other thing, that these are very, very different debates. And so this explainability versus performance question doesn't even apply in many of the things we're looking at, right? Because maybe a random forest, this is kind of what we use, is between a regression and a neural network. There's pretty good methods out there where you can explain where the forecast came from when you're using a random forest. It's a black box, but it's not that it's like impossible to explain. Then, of course, the other question is, what is the statement about causality here? Are you making causal statements, right? Because this is a big temptation when you have a regression, you have a coefficient, and your economists obviously love their regressions because these coefficients mean something in terms of if I do this up and down, then this happens. Of course, that all goes out of the window if you have a forecasting task, because the things that predict outcomes are not necessarily drivers of these outcomes. There's two layers here. One is explainability. The other one is the temptation to then use this explainability to then say, oh, okay, so if we do this or that, then this will not happen or this will change events in a certain way, right? And so we are holding back a little bit sometimes with explainability because we don't want the policymaker to then go away, turn around and go to their boss and say, hey, if we did this differently, then this wouldn't happen.
Yes.
Explainability is actually a double-edged sword.
Okay, let me pose another ethical question. If you have good forecasting, who gets to know about that forecasting? How widely is it shared?
This is one of my favorite topics right now. I don't know whether you know what the Lucas critique is, but
yes,
this is kind of a statement that says the response to a policy you have will be messed up by the expectations that the market actors have when you make that policy. There is something that I call the reverse Lucas critique, which is the forecast you make will be messed up by the policy response you're triggering with the forecast. If, for example, I predict that there will be conflict in France in a month from now, and I'm very good in forecasting, I have a lot of credibility, and people believe me, they have savings in France, they might withdraw funds, they have villas in southern France, and they say, oh my God, I better sell all this stuff, right? Then you have a complete sale of French assets, and the French economy collapses, and people are on the streets and rioting, and I can say, well, look, there is actually a riot and there is actually violence in France, right? And so this is what's called a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the response of actors, of policymakers to my forecast triggered my forecast to be true. You can have the opposite. You can have self-defeating forecasts where I make a forecast and people are trying to prevent it and then my forecast doesn't come true. The ethics of the forecast are completely different depending on whether you have a self-fulfilling or self-defeating forecast. Self-defeating forecasts, ethics drives you to make them public because that allows people to prevent things from happening. Self-fulfilling prophecies, the ethics drives you not to make them public, right? You want to keep them to yourself. This is the dilemma for a forecaster. Both things are contradicting the incentives to look good as a forecaster. This is a technological problem that hasn't been solved yet. So it's very fascinating. I talked to lots of people in machine learning, economics. Nobody knows how to solve this triple problem, forecasting, ethics, and policy response. I think it's terra incognita.
It sounds like there is a lot of work to be done. So just a final question for both of you. What research work needs to be done to be able to achieve this goal of automated prediction systems that can help with anticipatory action?
The first thing is obviously data. So better data work on where, for example, displacement is taking place, where people are at each moment in time, and what their situation is. On the architecture side, good research on explainability is important. We need better models to use panels effectively in forecasting. It's an interesting contrast here between economics that uses mostly linear models and machine learning uses like these nonlinear models, because nobody knows. Basically, the machine learning people are using cross-sectional data or time series data, and the economists use panel data, but they don't use machine learning. And so the cross between these two, I think, is quite interesting. And then, of course, there's this problem that I explained before, that causal inference and prediction at the same time is not well known, how we should do it and how it would work.
A part that we can come back to is the human element, right? At the end of the day, the START network system we explained earlier is a huge exception that there's almost no more human intervention. Like, there are these triggers, and once they're met, once enough metrics are above a certain threshold, then funding is released for anticipatory action, and that's the end of that. But I think especially in conflict forecasting that we're involved with, there's so much more nuance to making decisions and incorporating these forecasts into those decisions effectively. So I think there's plenty to be done in terms of capacity building within organizations, how to make sense of data effectively, mitigating the effects of algorithm aversion and people just kind of outright not wanting to trust forecasts at all, right? And I think that's where that motion came from, to say, well, we need explainability just to build that trust, because otherwise we create the best possible forecast and it's just ignored because people don't trust it. And yeah, making these insights actionable, and it will require time. It will require experimentation. And actually, we're just now at the end of a project where we've been trying to do exactly that. It was funded by the WFP, but we've been now working with the Kenyan Red Cross. We're creating subnational forecasts that have pretty good evaluation metrics, but seeing if this is good enough and of high value enough to really flow into the work that the Kenyan Red Cross is doing to anticipate conflict earlier. And they're already doing that through their own kind of old-fashioned forecasting means. Like Hannes was saying, people have a lot of experience, but they're using tons of meteorological data. They're not using conflict forecasts. And so we're bringing that in, and hopefully over the next half year, we'll know a lot more about the extent to which, at least at that level, that's useful. But we're also looking to work at a higher level, kind of HQ level, to see if it can flow in. It's also the entry point. The question is, who can make best use of this forecasting data in what way?
It's clearly challenging work, but it sounds like extremely exciting and promising work. So thank you for talking about it, Margarita.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
And Hannes as well.
Thanks a lot for having us.
We have been discussing Policy Insight 135, Harnessing AI, How to Develop and Integrate Automated Prediction Systems for Humanitarian Anticipatory Action. I'm not going to read out the list of authors. Why not download it from CPR and you can find out for yourself?
This has been a Vox Talk from the CEPR Paris Symposium 2024. Next week, ahead of the inauguration of President Trump, we look at what is causing the trade imbalance in the US economy and the policies intended to correct it.